Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 212 it is. We're cruising into 1858. But wait, the sounds of gunfire. Yes, it's that old South African tune, War, set to the music of the guns. Our society is steeped in action and movement and confrontation. This is not a place for the insipid, the weak, the fearful. Whatever our belief systems or our personal politics, what cannot be disputed is that the country and our ways are those of the warrior. This is an uncomfortable truth for metropolitans who are more used to single lattes than slingshots. Globally, 1858 was full of momentous events and incidents. It was the year in which Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace presented their papers on evolution by natural selection in London. In India, a peace treaty ended the Indian Rebellion, and later in the same year, the British Parliament passed the Government of India Act. This transferred the territories of the British East India Company and their administration to the direct rule of the British Crown. Another young girl dreamt up apparitions in the mode of Nonkawuse, who dreamed up the cattle killings. This time it was Bernadette Subaru, who claimed she saw several apparitions appear before her in the southern French town of Lourdes. Without going into too many gory details, around Ash Wednesday, a woman appeared before her inside a grotto, and after three appearances, over time, the woman began to talk. By October, the government had shut down the grotto. There were so many people pitching up to take part in what was called a miracle. A miracle only she could see and hear. Strange how these stories in this period of history repeated themselves. Back in Africa, David Livingstone's six-year-long second Zambezi expedition had arrived on the Indian Ocean coast, which is an important moment because inland the tension between the Boers of the Free State and King Mushweshwe of Basutoland had been exacerbated. 2 years earlier, in 1856, the Free State Volksraad had resolved that what was known as the Warden Line was the border between their territory and Basutu's. Mushweshwe disagreed. The Free Staters now wanted to mobilize a force of 800 Boers to ride to the Warden Line, and that was in 1857, and then issue an ultimatum to Mushweshwe. The king negotiated with the Boers, handed over some cattle as a good faith gesture which placated the commander, but he refused to hand over the horses and sent a letter to Sir George Grey, the Cape governor, saying, "My people have no confidence that when they give up their horses, which are their strength, war will not be made upon them for the sake of their ground." The divisions amongst the Boers delayed the inevitable. If you remember last episode, W.M. Pretorius, the Transvaal president, had been sent packing by the Free Staters when he rocked up and tried to take over the Free State from President Boshoff. Eventually, after a few more incidents, Pretorius signed a document acknowledging that the Free State was a separate independent entity, not owned by the Transvaal. This is where Paul Creer lurches into the picture. The future symbol of Boer resistance to British colonisation during the Anglo-Boer War rode to meet Mushweshwe late in 1857. Kruger urged Mushweshwe to create a diversion in the southern Free State by raiding cattle. Then the Transvaalers could attack the Free State from the north. Here was Kruger trying to whip up violence against his fellow Boer. Mushweshwe was far more astute in his dealings than that young man and sent some pacifying messages to both Boshoff and Pretorius. He didn't want to be seen to be taking sides and also understood the danger of taking advantage of an unstable situation. He sent a third message, this time to Sir George Grey, and he warned of an impending Boer civil war. "My heart is full of grief," he said, "when hearing that the Boers might shed blood." The irony was not lost on those back in London when they read the dispatch. Here was a Basutu king effectively acting as a peacemaker between the Boers. This kind of sensitive diplomacy was not going to stop the inevitable march to war between the Basutu and the Boers. The clashes began in the lower Caledon Valley, where Mushweshwe had sent his son Sekonyana to establish a village in the disputed zone. Both Basutu villages and Boer farms were jumbled together here. There was a boundary set by Maitland earlier, which Mushweshwe respected. Then another set by Commissioner Warden and respected by the Free State, but not Mushweshwe. With these farms and villages back-to-back, interspersed, it needed a strong leader to organize both sets of people. For a while, Sekonyana's presence did help. There was a sharp decline in stock theft. Other Basutu, like Moshoeshoe's younger brother, Bosholi, did not regard Sikonyana as their equal. He was their nephew, after all. By the beginning of 1858, Bosholi began to occupy Boer tenant farms, damaging homesteads and raiding orchards and cattle. By this time, the Boers had come to rely on wool-bearing sheep as their main product for exchange and profit. Their demand for beef and cattle products had diminished. Earlier, they had herded mainly fat-tailed sheep and cattle, but the burgeoning wool trade out of South Africa had caused many to switch to merino sheep. Travellers to parts of the Free State noted that butter and dairy products accounted for more profit than pure beef sales. They could not move these products further afield, of course. Transporting milk was very difficult during these times. Wool was a different story. According to a census conducted in 1856, Boers in the Orange Free State owned 1,231,849 sheep and goats, and only 137,164 head of cattle. Yes, apparently someone had gone to the trouble to count each and every one. Cattle were also less adapted to the dry environment of the then Orange Free State, and frequent droughts had played a part as well. Feed is too short and scanty for horned cattle, but sheep can continue to grow in tougher times. Sheep require less labour, except during shearing season. Otherwise, not much else. And wool farming is suitable for the seasonable labour provided by Basutu and other people around the farms. The rise in land speculation, which I've covered previously, had an impact on our story today. Low land fees had encouraged speculators, leading to the Orange Free State imposing an additional fee of £5 on each unoccupied farm, which in turn increased the number of bewoner or tenant farmers. Since a farm by law had to have a white tenant, speculators, who were usually British, allowed Boers unable to buy the land for themselves to settle on these farms. Gradually, the poorer Boers found themselves without land, and they were pushed to the edges of these farming areas into the disputed territories. Land prices had accelerated, and by 1858, farms were selling for 10 times their original price. It was these Boers, mostly the ones who could not afford to buy farms inside the Free State, that were taking advantage of the disputed land. A drought was reported in the region in 1858, which made everything worse. The Volksraad met in February 1858. They were faced with a request to help to deal with Bosholi. That request was signed by a Veldkornet and 65 other burghers in the disputed area. Historian Leonard Thompson writes about this in his book Survival in Two Worlds, Moshoeshoe of Lesotho. He read the journal of French missionary L. J. Cochet, who was stationed in Hebron. That was inside the disputed zone. Cochet lived amongst the Basutu villages scattered between Boer farms. Now the Veldkornet had upped the ante. It was time to determine once and for all where the border lay. Later in February 1858, Smithfield Landdrost Jacobus Sauer sent more news from the Badlands. Bosholi was in fact, in his words, parading through Smithfield district with warriors, and when accosted, he said he was on a hunting expedition. Perhaps one of these days I'll do a special episode on the link between hunting expeditions and military expeditions. Everyone did it, you know. The British, the Boers, the Mazulu, the Swazi, the Basutu, etc., etc. Often the distinction was the weapon carried, hunting spear versus war spear, elephant gun versus the new invention called the rifled musket. Bosof and other leaders knew that the drought was causing problems across the land, and that the Basutu often hunted further afield when local game died out. The Boers were also battling the same drought. The weather is non-racial, you know, and had reacted badly to calls that they may have to help fight the Basutu. There were still unresolved issues with the Griqua in the Southwest Free State. The Boers here were loath to be conscripted into a commando, which would leave their farms exposed. Some of the burghers questioned the logic of causing a commotion with a Basutu chief who was obviously not directly threatening him. It was not like Mzilikazi Kakumalo with the Amandebele or the Amazulu. Bosof had other problems. His internecine spat with Pretorius of the Transvaal had led to a backlash. There was a political struggle taking place inside the Free State Volksraad, and on the 25th of February, Bosof had had enough of the squabbling and resigned. That didn't last long. 4 days later, Bosof reluctantly returned to work as president after the members of the Volksraad changed their minds, realized they needed him. Still, Bosshoff was in a weakened position, made worse by the muttering and finger-waving from the sanguine Landros, Jacobus Sauer, which is ironic because his son, Jacobus Willemus Sauer, would go on to become one of the most liberal politicians of early South Africa. He was so liberal that by the 1880s, he wanted blacks and women to have the vote. Unfortunately for the Basutu and probably the Boers, his father was a bit more hardcore. Being of the old school, he argued strategy with Bosshoff. The Free State president was hoping to mobilize a few hundred Boers as a kind of show of force, which he thought would convince Moshoeshoe to discipline his brother Bosholi. Sauer was having none of it. He wanted to start a war with Bosholi, then deal with the whole Basutu nation. He wanted to go after Moshoeshoe. After a stormy session of the Free State Volksraad, Sauer was joined by two other Veldkornets and two members of the Volksraad in a face-to-face meeting with Sekonyana. He was joined by another of Moshoeshoe's sons, Sophonia, Mahlomi's grandson, Ltabenya, and three of Bosholi's councillors. Mahlomi, just to refresh everyone's memory, was born around 1720 at Futani near present-day Mashang or Friesberg in the Free State. Mahlomi lived at Ingolilo, which was the headquarters of his chiefdom, and became a place where Mahlomi established his ethics academy, but he didn't call it that, of course. His political nous was enormous, but his actions in guiding the pre-colonial Basutu are remarkable. Claiming he was guided by ancestral dreams, he wooed French missionaries with his concepts of justice. They said his government was that of a prince distinguished for clemency and wisdom. Mahlomi eradicated beliefs in witchcraft and made it illegal to put anyone to death on an accusation of witchcraft. By anyone, he meant mainly women, because it was they who were regarded as suspected witches normally. He then went after the shameless shamans. In one simple test, Chief Mahlomi hid his shield and called on the seers and diviners to assist him in finding it. During this staged episode, the so-called diviners and seers began pointing out suspects, whom they accused of trying to bewitch the chief by taking away his shield. When they were done with their hocus-pocus, Mahlomi retrieved his shield from its hiding place to prove that the divinations and accusations of the diviners and seers were unfounded. Case closed. It was Mahlomi who eventually instructed his protege, Moshoeshoe, and here was Moshoeshoe using Mahlomi's mentoring to good end, along with Mahlomi's own grandson, Ltabenya, facing the Boers, discussing a solution to this crisis. I'm sure Jacobus Sauer had no idea who Ltabenya was, nor would he have cared, no doubt. Sauer took copious notes of the meeting, including a paragraph where he pointedly claims Sekonyana admitted that Bosholi and Ltabenya had robbed and harassed the Boers, but also noted that Sekonyana said nothing had been proven. Sekonyana did clearly send his own message to Sauer, saying that no one had the right to remove people from the disputed territories because King Moshoeshoe had put them there. Nothing was resolved. Hearing about this meeting, some of the Basutu living in the disputed territory decided to throw in their lot with the Boers, including Leteri, who was another of Mahlomi's sons. Why? Because the Boers promised Leteri and his followers that they could keep any cattle rustled from other Basutu in the upcoming clashes. Bosholi and Ltabenya and most of the other Basutu living in this troubled region remained loyal to Moshoeshoe. So now we have the son of the wise man, Mahlomi, versus the grandson of wise man, Mahlomi, on different sides. Sauer sat down that night with his fellow Boers, including Bosshoff and the military officers and members of the Volksraad, to discuss next steps. They called this a war council, which kind of gave the intentions away. Moshoeshoe, they agreed, should face the final countdown. If Sekonyana did not agree to vacate the disputed territory, Bosshoff would send Moshoeshoe an ultimatum with a deadline for withdrawal. Meanwhile, the Volksraad proceeded to call up the burghers, who, as I've explained, were not pleased to be conscripted in the midst of the challenges they were facing. This is a case of trying to fix something that wasn't quite broken. Yes, the border was a grey area, the territory ill-defined, cattle raiding going on. Instead of sorting out the boundary line through discussion and negotiation, the Free State Volksraad decided to revert to the time-honoured tradition of trying to bludgeon their opponents into submission, which is militarily clever if you have a 3-to-1 advantage in men or an exaggerated advantage in equipment. The Boers did not. When the commander eventually gathered, there were 1,000 armed and mounted Boers, which was exactly 10% the size of the Basutu force of 10,000, all mounted with at least 500 firearms. Throw in the fact that the burghers would rather be at home on the plas, sorting out their sheep and cattle and doing normal plas-type things in the midst of a drought, and you could see that Bossoff, and in particular Sauer, were not deploying what you'd call critical thinking 101. So Bossoff handed Sekonyana the ultimatum on the 11th of March, which demanded that Moshoeshoe was to officially declare in writing that he was going to force Bashuli and Dabenya to leave the frontier zone. He was also to pay compensation for earlier rustling and raiding, and he should recognize the Warden Line as the boundary between the Free State and the Basutu. No response. On the 19th of March, Bossoff declared war. Yeah, were two sets of warriors, both raised on horseback. They were like brothers from another mother, but that's probably stretching things. Still, you get the picture. Not only were the Basutu and the Boers astute horsemen, both peoples organized their warriors on a territorial basis. The Boers had commando units from towns and rural areas and identified themselves as such, and so too did the Basutu cavalry. Both sides brought their own horses and supplies, their own logistic support, teenagers who brought the second horse, who would strike the camp, light the fires and cook the food. When it came to the Boers, each district was divided into three wards or more, with a felt cornet for each ward and a commandant taking military control of the entire district. The Basutu had a chief or commander in charge of the village or the region who would lead the cavalry from that village, just like the Boers. The 1,000 men on the Boer side split and gathered at two points, Smithfield in the south, Binbach in the north. The Boers had something that Moshoeshoe did not have, artillery. Seven small field guns were going to be towed into Basutu land behind horses, along with dozens of wagons carrying supplies and to form defensive lagers. The two-phase pincer from the Boers would move simultaneously towards the target, Moshoeshoe's great place, Thabo Basu. Back at the Thabo Basu ranch, Moshoeshoe was a sea of calm. It was now war, and the king, along with the territorial chiefs and councillors, put their plans into motion. They'd faced this kind of attack before. The British had raided them in 1852, if you recall. That had ended in disaster for the empire, the Battle of Berea. So Moshoeshoe was not rattled by the latest assault on his independence. First, herders took most of the livestock deep into the Moloti Mountains, the real bad, badlands. Then loyal Basutu inside the disputed territory retreated across the rivers, heading towards Thabo Basu. Some warriors were left in place with strict instructions. Should the Boers attack in force, they should withdraw to fight another day. Strategically, Moshoeshoe told his commanders that the Boers, led by hotheads like Sauer, would not stick to the western side of the disputed Warden Line. He knew they were going to try and come to defeat him. That was their chosen way when they dealt with black chiefs. Had the Boers remained west of the Warden Line, Moshoeshoe would have lost his land without a fight. As the Boers advanced, Moshoeshoe launched his third part of the plan. As many of the Boers had feared, Moshoeshoe had designed a counterattack. Many of his younger warriors spread out behind the Boers and began to ransack the now undefended farmhouses. The Northern Free State column advanced from Binbach to a drift across the Caledon River, where the capital Maseru is today. They came under immediate attack by Modapo, Modetsani, and Moperi's regiments between April 12th and April 14th, 1858. Instead of forging on directly towards Thabo Basu, they turned and marched down the right bank, the western bank of the Caledon, to Yamabach Drift, and waited the arrival of the southern column. This column had been very busy indeed, but hardly covered themselves in glory. They attacked the French mission stations and Basutu villages, particularly destroying the homes at Beersheba. Most of the people had vacated these missions and villages, so the southern column turned east and destroyed Bashuli's homes, along with Dabenya's villages. Completing the carnage, they crossed the Caledon River and then ran straight into Chief Letsi's very well-trained warriors at Bahali's Hook. 15 Boers were killed. Still, they pressed into Basutu land, and on the 25th of April, they joined up with the northern column and then headed to Maria, burning all homesteads and crops as they went. They were particularly bent on destroying the missionaries' property, and during this rampage set fire to a set of extremely valuable documents and records kept by Abusay. Back at Thabo Basu, Wesleyan missionaries had visited Moshoeshoe and were struck by his calmness. While they spoke, children ran about, men were sewing skins together to make karosses, women doing their normal domestic chores. One could scarcely think that a battle was about to be fought which might decide the fate of the reigning dynasty and the country generally, said one. During the meetings in April, a breathless messenger arrived, saying the fighting had started at Cathcart's Drift. The Basutos had surrounded the Boers. They wanted to know if they should fall on the camp and destroy it. Mosreshwe thought for a moment, then said, no. If the enemy persist in coming into my country, my people must fight. But if the Dutch farmers wish to fall back and retire to their own land, let them do so without being pursued. Let them have a way out. Don't eviscerate a small group. Surely a larger group will follow in revenge. Merely lead them on. If they make the mistake of committing a full frontal attack, yes, we fight. But always give them an exit route. Sometimes jiu-jitsu does beat kung fu. The Boers did indeed push onwards as Mosreshwe had hoped. On the 6th of May, the Free State burghers formed a laager at the foot of Thabo Basu, and the Basutu king gazed down on them like a man on Masada. Unlike the Romans at Masada, the besiegers in the laager below Thabo Basu were not in a good place. Many of the burghers were receiving bad news about what was happening on their vacated farms. Basutu raiding parties had made merry, causing havoc, seizing livestock, burning homes, just like the Boers had been doing. One good dose of arson, looting and chaos deserves another, you know. All the burning and destroying the Boers had been doing boomeranged. To make matters worse, Khoisan leader Shiel Kobus had joined up with two Tlapping chiefs who were now cattle rustling on the grand scale inside the Free State. The morale of the Free State burghers collapsed. On the 8th of May, they fired a few desultory rounds from their artillery pieces up one of the hills, hitting Mosreshwe's western-style house. Then both columns retreated across the Caledon River, just like the British had been forced to do 5 years earlier. In fact, they crossed the same drift on their forlorn march home. History is the toughest professor in the University of Life. Back in the Cape, Sir George Grey was going grey with worry, concerned about reports of a war between the Boers and the Basutu. He was even more worried when he heard that Boshoff had swallowed his pride and had approached Pretorius, his arch-Boer enemy, for help to defeat Mosreshwe. Pretorius said he would love to help on one condition, that the Free State would merge with the Transvaal. Many Free Staters were now warming up to that idea, but before they could go ahead with a grand unification, Grey made his move. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog where I'll load an update about the series. You can email me from there too. Until next, goodbye.